Universal Time. Stay tuned for Daybreak Africa coming up after these latest world news headlines.
I'm Jonathan Jones reporting. A North Korean soldier has defected to South Korea, crossing the demilitarized zone, that report coming from Seoul's defense ministry. He emerged from a thick fog. The low-ranking soldier appeared in front of a guard post around 8 a.m. Thursday, according to the semi-official South Korean Yonhap News Agency. The defense ministry said there was no gunfire from soldiers in the north in the latest incident, unlike one a month ago when a North Korean soldier drove a jeep down a tree-lined road and then ran across the DMZ under a hail of at least 40 bullets from his ex-comrades. He suffered at least 5 gunshot wounds. President Trump and his Republican supporters in Congress are celebrating the passage of a tax overhaul, the first major legislative victory of Trump's presidency. The bill permanently cuts corporate taxes, temporarily cuts taxes paid by American wage earners, and increases the U.S. national debt by at least $1 trillion over a decade. Democrats say the legislation mortgages America's future at home and abroad in order to pad the pockets of the wealthy. Republicans argued that tax cuts will rev up the economy and make American businesses more competitive at home and abroad. U.S. Senator Mark Warner, a Democrat, has spoken out about what he calls a growing chorus of irresponsible and reckless voices calling for an end to Special Counsel Robert Mueller's investigation of ties between Russia and the Trump campaign. He said such a move has the potential to provoke a constitutional crisis. This is VOA News. 8 Americans were among the 12 people killed in Mexico Tuesday after a tour bus carrying passengers from Royal Caribbean cruise ships crashed along a highway. 2 Swedes, 1 Canadian, and a tour guide were also among the dead. Scientists warn a campaign to eradicate polio in Central Africa is falling short because of upheaval in the Lake Chad Basin area, where Boko Haram remains active. On the positive side, Gabon has been declared a polio-free country. Correspondent Moki Edwin Kinzeka reports from Yaoundé.
Professor Rose Leke, who heads the Africa Regional Certification Commission for Polio Eradication, says Central Africa has seen no cases of polio in the past 15 months. But she adds scientists cannot be sure the polio virus has been eradicated in the region. Leke says medical teams find it difficult getting access to conflict zones in Mali, the Central African Republic, the Democratic Republic of Congo, and parts of Cameroon, Chad, Niger, and Nigeria affected by the Boko Haram insurgency.
DRC has circulating polioviruses, so many of them were really worried about the country, and so we had specific recommendations also for RDC and for all the others.
We're still very concerned about the Lake Chad Basin area, the Borno area, where we don't know what's happening there. I think that's a concern for the entire world.
Moki, Edwin Kinzeka for VOA News, Yaoundé.
The Ugandan parliament has overwhelmingly voted to eliminate presidential age limits. That paves the way for one of Africa's longest-serving leaders to rule until 2031. Under the current law, 73-year-old President Yoweri Museveni would not be eligible to run in the next presidential election in 2021. But by a vote of 315 to 62, the lawmakers amended the Constitution, removing a measure that prevents anyone younger than 35 or older than 75 from holding the presidency. The new bill does introduce term limits, but they will only come into force after the next election. That means Museveni could serve 2 more 5-year terms. Many Ugandans took to social media to voice their disappointment at the passage of the bill. One, a political historian at Uganda's Makerere University, said, "It is a dark day and a backward move toward disaster. I don't see anything positive in it." There's more on these and other late-breaking and developing stories from around the world around the clock at voanews.com and on the VOA News mobile app. I'm Jonathan Jones reporting from the world headquarters of the Voice of America in Washington.
That's the latest world news from VOA.
Good morning, Africa. Welcome to Daybreak Africa from the Voice of America. I'm James Butte in Washington. Today is Thursday, December 21st, and here are some of the stories we are covering. South Sudan warring factions meeting in Addis Ababa worked late into the night without reaching a ceasefire agreement.
The government delegation is arguing that South Sudan is a sovereign state. It should not be prevented from acquiring arms at any time it wants to.
That's VOA's John Tanza in the Ethiopian capital, Addis Ababa. A new report accuses the DRC government and its allied militias of committing atrocities in Kasai province. Togo's opposition coalition is planning fresh new protests despite calls for a dialogue. And Zimbabwe's new president addresses the nation on wide-ranging issues, including the economy.
My government is committed to open Zimbabwe up to investment by building a free and transparent economy which benefits Zimbabweans and is welcoming to outsiders.
Meanwhile, the U.S. ambassador to Zimbabwe says the U.S. is open to supporting the new government depending on what the government does and the healing powers of music. Those stories, plus our listener of the day, are coming up on Daybreak Africa. More than 100 members representing various South Sudan warring factions meeting in Addis Ababa worked late into the night without reaching a ceasefire agreement. The gathering is sponsored by the Intergovernmental Authority on Development, also known as IGAD, and it aims at revitalizing the 2015 peace agreement. Reporter John Tanza of VOA Sudan in Focus program is covering the forum in Addis Ababa. He says the delegates could not reach a consensus on some key issues in the draft permanent ceasefire document.
The latest is that the stakeholders to the South Sudan Revitalization Forum have not signed a ceasefire agreement that they were supposed to have ended up discussing. I mean, the agreement on cessation of hostilities, protection of civilians and humanitarian access in South Sudan was supposed to be the basis of starting these negotiations. And the delegates were locked up from 12 midday Wednesday in a meeting, and they didn't come out until around 6 in the evening, and they went back again at around 8:30 p.m. And I left the venue at around 12:30 a.m. this morning, and they have not signed any document.
What do you think is the reason for the inability to come to an agreement? What are the reasons?
Now, the reasons are there's Article 3 in the agreement which talks about the obligations of the parties under the cessation of hostilities. Now, if you go to Article 3, Section E, it says that there will be no illegal acquisition of weapons and armaments during the cessation of hostilities. The government delegation is arguing that South Sudan is a sovereign state. It should not be prevented from acquiring arms at any time it wants to. Another sticking point was the opposition was requesting that the CITESAN is a monitoring body that's mandated by the 2015 peace agreement to report and monitor cases of violations. And so the opposition groups were requesting that CITESAN should be based outside South Sudan because they are saying having citizens based in Juba, it's under the mercy of the government because the government will control the monitors. The government will fit to give the monitors access whenever they feel like. So the opposition was demanding that citizens should be relocated out of South Sudan. But it looks like that area was resolved. But one of the sticking points here is the issue of purchasing of arms and ammunition.
John, I mean, I listened to your report sent in on Tuesday, and it seems to me all the civil society people attending, the issue of cessation of hostilities was very important to them. From where you sit, observing this meeting, do you think the delegates will be able to iron out their differences?
I think it's fair to say that the differences that have emerged of late just minor issues, but, you know, they are important to both parties. The government is insisting that the agreement should not prohibit their ability to run the country as they see fit. And the opposition is saying, if you are signing a cessation of hostilities, you have to abide by its rules. But the overall assessment is that the two parties, the opposition groups and the government delegation, have all agreed that there is a need for cessation of hostilities, there is a need for ending the violence. But how is the $1 million question? Because if you look at this document on the cessation of hostilities and protection of civilians and humanitarian access, it's a beautiful document. But as they say, the devil is in the details.
John Tanza, thank you very much again. So nice to talk with you. We look forward to speaking with you again tomorrow.
My pleasure, James Buddy.
That's reporter John Tanza of VOA's Sudan in Focus program covering the Addis Ababa Forum of South Sudan Warring Factions. A new report by the International Federation for Human Rights has accused the DRC government and its allied militias of committing atrocities in Kasai province. The group said it based its conclusion on testimonies it gathered last July from Congolese refugees who fled the Kamonian territory in the Kasai province to Angola. The group calls on the DRC government to put an end to what it calls human rights violations in Kasai and to conduct an independent investigation into the alleged crimes and bring those responsible to justice. The DRC government was not immediately available to respond to the allegations. Cleophas Katumba is a Congolese analyst from the Kasai province. He says, if possible, the International Federation for Human Rights plans to take this case to the International Criminal Court.
The conclusion of the report is about that the government forces and the militias, Kamuina Nsapu, and they've committed serious crimes in the province of Kasai, specifically in the Kamonya town.
How do you know the government committed those crimes?
Yeah, the FIDH, which is a human rights organization, the headquarters based in France, in Paris, they went to Angola and spoke to the refugees, those who fled the conflict in Kasai. So they spoke to the victims, and the statement made by the victims have come to the conclusion that the government and those militias, they've committed crime against humanity.
So you interview people who left the DRC and went to Angola?
Yeah, those people were interviewed by the FIDH, which is the Federation International for Droit de l'Homme, in French, acronym. So they spoke to them. I was not part of that team, but in some way I collaborated with that team. But I am an analyst from Congo, and my origins from the Kasai region.
We have spoken many times with the Congolese Minister of Information, and when you talk about the Kasai region, the government indicates that it is fighting rebels in that area. What do you say to that?
What I know that the Kamuina Nsapu militias, they were not really rebel in per se. These people, they start to protest against the government because the government was taking side in a traditional conflict. So the government took side and they were not happy. They were fighting official from the government. But when you look the sort of the weapon they used and what the government has used, there is no common measure between those weapons. So calling them rebels, I think it's kind of exaggeration.
What do you hope to come out of this report?
I think the International Federation of Human Rights, which is based in Paris here, they want first to really inform people based on the statement made by the victims what really took place in Kasai. Secondly, they wanted to really inform the international community and the Congolese that the crime against humanity were committed in Kasai, and also they are planning to take this case to the ICC.
To the ICC against the government of the DRC?
Against the government and the militias as well.
Cleophas Katumba is a Congolese analyst from the Kasai province. He was speaking with me from the French capital, Paris. You are listening to Daybreak Africa on the Voice of America. I'm James Barty in Washington. Today is Thursday, December 21st. Daybreak Africa time is 15 minutes past the hour. Zimbabwe President Emmerson Mnangagwa on Wednesday vowed to ensure the rule of law, fight corruption, and act laws that attract investors and conduct free and fair elections next year. But, as Sebastian Mofu reports for VOA, the opposition says the country's new president and his government are no different from the old regime of Robert Mugabe.
President Mnangagwa pledged that Zimbabwe would unveil a, quote, robust, unquote, re-engagement policy and open up to foreign investment as he delivered his first State of the Nation address since taking office about a month ago. The president's remarks come as he prepares to head South Africa Thursday to meet with the potential investors. Mnangagwa also sought to reassure Zimbabweans about the integrity of elections expected in 2018.
My government is committed to entrenching a democratic society driven by respect for the Constitution, the rule of law, mutual tolerance, peace and unity. To this end, government will do all in its power to ensure that the 2018 harmonized general elections are credible, free and fair.
However, the president's special advisor, Christopher Mtshangwa, told the media last weekend that the ruling ZANU-PF party would use the military to ensure victory next year. The International Commission of Jurists told VOA that Mnangagwa, who came into power on the back of the army, must not rely on the military for policing Zimbabweans as the country prepares for the elections. Tendai Biti is a member of the opposition People's Democratic Party and former finance minister. He says many Zimbabweans are worried about the military's involvement in politics and that Mnangagwa's cabinet had been, quote, militarized, unquote, by having two retired generals, including the one who announced that the army, quote, had taken over, unquote, state institutions.
We have nothing per se against the military, but we know that the essence of the rule of law and constitutionalism is that of democracy, and democracy is government for the people and by the people. And so the people that are ultimately decisive in our country are the ordinary citizens who have the right to choose men and women who will serve them. You cannot make a transition from a barrack to a public office. So we are concerned about that.
Nelson Chamisa, the vice president of the main opposition party, Movement for Democratic Change, says the new government has nothing to offer Zimbabweans.
We are not only confident, we don't only believe that we will form the next government. We know it. And Mr. Mnangagwa knows it. We are going to be the next government. This is why they are panicking. But we are saying even if you form the next government, it's going to be a good dispensation for Mr. Mnangagwa and his team, because we'll be very inclusive, tolerant of the opposition.
President Mnangagwa is expected to appoint former head of the army, Constantino Chiwenga, as his vice president after retiring him this week, court pending redeployment, unquote. Sebastian Mofu for VOA News, Harare.
The U.S. ambassador to Zimbabwe says the U.S. is open to supporting the new government of President Emmerson Mnangagwa, depending on what that government does in terms of holding free and fair elections, upholding freedom of speech, and especially providing jobs for Zimbabweans. Ambassador Harry Thomas Jr. says any decision to lift U.S. sanctions on Zimbabwe will be made based on the performance of the Mnangagwa government.
We think that people want free and fair elections. They want freedom of speech. Most importantly, they want jobs. They want cash, the ability to pay tuition for their children, take their families on vacations, and have opportunity. So we very much are supportive of the new Zimbabwe.
But do you see the new government delivering that?
It's too early to say. And that's just a fair assessment. They haven't had much time in office. The finance minister delivered his budget speech last week. President Mnangagwa gave his State of the Nation address today. It's too early to tell, but we are heartened by the promises both made in terms of what they want to do on the economic side.
So, Ambassador, from what has happened, because there have been this talk about the too much involvement of the military, of course they've said they're going back into the barracks, but people are still saying that this is like some kind of military junta. What do you make of the new government?
We want to give the new government a chance, as do the Zimbabwean people. We want to see if they are able to provide jobs, health care, educational opportunities. And we're going to take them at their word because they promised all of this. And that is something we support. We want to see this done in accordance with your wonderful 2013 Constitution. Nothing could be better for the Zimbabwean people. But it takes time. The economy is in tatters. To turn around an economy in a short time will be a Herculean task, but we want to show them that American investors, American companies are interested in Zimbabwe given the right challenges. After all, Pepsi-Cola just opened, Pizza Hut is going to open after Christmas. American businesses are very, very interested in the opportunities they will have in Zimbabwe.
Maybe the main question that Zimbabweans and all those who are listening is about the issue of sanctions, mm-hmm. because the Zimbabwean government, the previous leadership and the present, they are all talking of one thing, mm-hmm. that sanctions imposed on Zimbabwe mm-hmm. or those targeted sanctions mm-hmm. imposed on others, on some Zimbabwean leaders, is impeding development in Zimbabwe. What is the U.S. going to do about this?
Well, as you know, sanctions and that issue for the United States government and other governments are up to our president and our legislature. What we have told the Zimbabweans is they need to lobby our legislature, lobby our executive branch. But any decision on those issues are going to be made based on performance. And so it's very important that elections be free and fair and nonviolent, as President Mnangagwa has promised. Very important that he end corruption, as he has promised.
Harry Thomas Jr. is the U.S. ambassador to Zimbabwe. He spoke with reporter Chris Gandhi of VOA's Studio 7 Zimbabwe program. Togo's 14-party opposition coalition says it is planning 3 days of fresh protests on December 27th, 28th, and 30th. The parties are demanding a return to Togo's 1992 constitution, which calls for a 2 5-year term limit for presidents and also for President Faure Gnassingbé's resignation. The renewed protests come despite a call by West African leaders last week for the Togolese government and the opposition to hold inclusive dialogue. The protests also come after the government said last week it released 24 opposition prisoners. Kojo Delava is Secretary General of Togo's main opposition National Alliance for Change Party. He says the government must free political prisoners and withdraw its army from key cities to allow the citizens there to participate in the protests.
We resume next week. We will be protesting and demonstrating this coming Wednesday, Tuesday, and Saturday, that is on the 27th, 28th, and 30th of this December. On 29th, which is a Friday, we request everybody to stay home and to make as much as noise as possible, congoning anything we can do to make noise in the city.
At the end of the ECOWAS meeting last week, the West African leaders called on you, the opposition, and the Togolese government to hold what they called inclusive dialogue. Why are you continuing protest when you are supposed to be holding dialogue?
Well, what we can what come out from this meeting is putting everybody is a request. The ECOWAS meeting called Togolese people to talk and to compromise. But there are some preliminaries to before the talks begin. That is, it means free all the political prisoners and also make the army to pull back from the cities as Sokode, Bafilo and Mango. Those cities are under military occupation and people are not free there to demonstrate or to participate to any public manifestation, any demonstration they can. So we want all those preliminaries to be done by the government so that the talks can take place in a peaceful atmosphere.
But I did speak with the spokesperson for the government, Mr. Bawara, and he indicated to me last week that to date, the government has freed about 24 opposition members, including two imams. Isn't that sufficient for a dialogue to begin?
This is not sufficient because many people still remains to be free. And we don't know why the government will not free everybody. All those opposition people who still are detainees, who still are in the government prison, should be free. That's what everybody claims. Four talks can begin. That's all. And also, what the militaries are looking for in these three cities I mentioned before.
Kojo Delava is the Secretary General of Togo's May Opposition National Alliance for Change Party. He was speaking with me from the capital, Lome. Music hath charms, the saying goes, and it does have power to make us happy, sad, or even ignite social change. But it is also a healing power, and researchers want to know how that works. Viewer's Kevin Enoch reports.
The soothing sounds of a violin and the graceful movements of dancers can help take people's minds off painful hospital procedures like chemotherapy.
It reduces anxiety, and it can also help decrease the amount of medication that a patient needs.
Researchers at the National Institutes of Health are studying how exactly music affects the body.
If we can study the arts in the same way that science studies medications and other therapeutics, I think we will be doing so much good for cura personalis, or care of the whole person.
This here opera singer Renee Fleming is part of the study, working with researcher David Jangraw.
If you really want to engage certain parts of the brain, you have to get the person to actually sing along or play an instrument or become part of the music making process.
Fleming underwent brain scans while speaking, singing, or imagining a piece of music. What researchers discovered is that processing music is an incredibly complex process, and imagining music may be even more complicated. And that music may be a pathway to engage parts of the brain and speed up the healing process.
What neuroscience can do is help us understand which parts of the brain are active when we're making music. And if we find out that that part of the brain is also affected by a disease or a disorder or an injury, now we know that music can be a part of the solution to helping that part of the brain.
But beyond healing, learning or playing music keeps the brain sharp, improves kids' language skills, and helps improve grades. Kevin Enix, VOA News.
And that's it for this Thursday, December 21st edition of Daybreak Africa. Join us again tomorrow for more Africa news and features right here on the English to Africa service of the Voice of America. On behalf of the Daybreak Africa crew, producer Nicole Beckford, reporters Peter Clotty and Ricky Stryak, as well as sports editor Samson O'Malley, along with all of our engineers, I'm James Butte in Washington, wishing you in Africa a very, very good day.
Hello, Africa. This is Peter Clotty, host of VOA's Africa Weekend show, Nightline Africa. Tune in. You will be glad you did.
Nightline Africa is a fast-paced, tightly edited news show designed to keep our listeners engaged from beginning to end. Nightline comes to you live from the Voice of America on the following shortwave frequencies: 6080 kHz, 49.3 meter band, and 15580 kHz, 19.2 meter band.